are the United States and Somalia. After convening several national conferences on children's rights over the next years, I was asked by King Hussein to establish and chair a National Task Force for Children, NTFC, to monitor and evaluate the status of Jordan's children. To encourage and facilitate cooperation among often competing organizations, we established a National Coalition for Children that coordinated and promoted partnerships among all public and private institutions involved with children's affairs. The NTFC also established a National Policy and Research Center, as well as Jordan's first child information system on the World Wide Web. The Information and Research Center has focused on critically important issues, such as child labor, urban poverty, youth and culture, smoking among teens, and gaps and priorities in development research and programs. In those early days, I also assumed an active role with the Royal Society for the Conservation of Nature, RSCN. The society was unique in the region. Founded under King Hussein's patronage in 1966, when few people were talking about conservation, the RSCN was the first, and for a long time the only, national environmental protection organization in the Middle East. I was particularly proud of this, because conservation had long been a serious concern of mine. In 1970, while a freshman at Princeton, I had cheered on UN Secretary General U Thant when he declared the first annual worldwide celebration of Earth Day. That sense of global unity and the universal need to balance the health of the environment with the requirements of mankind was as compelling to me then as it is today. King Hussein and the original founders of the RSCN set a personal example by giving up hunting, because their favorite sport was having such a negative impact on Jordan's wildlife. This concern was the seed of the RSCN's growing role over the years in protecting Jordan's fragile natural wonders from the impact of development. In 1978, the RSCN reached out to various international organizations, including the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and the World Wildlife Fund, for assistance in identifying specific areas in the country to be set aside as nature reserves. The RSCN established 6 protected areas that would generate income for local communities from conservation-based activities. Jordan has also set an example in protected areas management for surrounding countries and has provided on-the-job training for conservationists around the region. From the beginning, I tried to listen and learn from as many different sources as possible, to develop consensus among my most trusted advisors. I also began to leverage my gradually expanding national and international network of experts, potential partners, and funding support for the country. Once key model programs in education, women's issues, and poverty eradication were successful in Jordan, we began to focus on regional outreach programs. I urged everyone I worked with to speak freely and offer honest, constructive criticism. I especially valued the straight talkers, who went on to become friends and counselors. There was nothing for me to learn from sycophants who would tell me what they thought would please me rather than the truth. I also wanted to promote the concept of teamwork that would contribute to meaningful and substantive improvements in the quality of people's lives and their opportunities for the future. By talking to experts, I learned that students in Jordanian high schools and universities were not being given career counseling. The vast majority of students were studying medicine, engineering, and law, fields that were already glutted with graduates seeking employment, yet we did not have enough qualified specialists in a multitude of fields such as computer engineering, hotel management, traffic engineering, and early childhood development. In 1979, I established the Royal Endowment for Culture and Education, which conducted the first research on the country's specific manpower needs and awarded scholarships, with special emphasis on outstanding women, to students pursuing graduate studies in fields vital to Jordan's future development. over the next 2 decades, those scholarship recipients would become leaders in their fields, reinforcing our premise that individuals can make a profound difference in accelerating the pace of development. My background in urban planning and architecture led me early on to think how Jordan could manage its growth more carefully. I was very aware of my husband's frustrations with the construction nightmare of Hashimiya, indeed with almost every home he had built. Having worked in the country, I was also very conscious of the problems we had had with building projects at the airline. It had become apparent to me that we had a critical need for standardized building codes. Not long after my marriage, I invited the Minister of Public Works to my office at El Ma'wa. "Help me understand our building codes," I asked him. Without a word, he opened the suitcase he had brought with him and emptied it out onto the floor. In the heap were books of standard building codes from countries all over the world. But it turned out that we did not have a binding one of our own. With his encouragement, I called for a meeting of the key engineers and architects in Jordan to ask them what sorts of problems they were dealing with and what they felt could be done to establish uniform building requirements. There was general agreement that the government and the private sector needed to work together to formulate such regulations. Over the next few years, the Royal Scientific Society produced Jordan's first building code, and I learned a valuable lesson about one role I could play as queen, as a catalyst for consensus building and action. I also proposed a committee of specialists to assume responsibility for the conservation of our architectural heritage and the proper review of designs for new public buildings and spaces. This was a partial success in that it positively influenced a number of key projects, but its effectiveness remained subject to the whims of cabinet officials. This experience caused me to appreciate the challenges the Prince of Wales would face in his efforts in the United Kingdom to promote awareness of the impact and import of public design in reinforcing civic pride and national culture. I felt that such an approach was particularly vital for Aqaba. If we did not plan that beautiful resort area at the northern tip of the Red Sea very carefully, we would perpetuate the chaotic planning that had existed to date and miss an opportunity to give Aqaba a unique Jordanian character unlike any other resort in the world. If it was going to be a successful tourist destination, Aqaba had to have a distinct personality. We did make some progress in greening the area by planting palm trees along the roads and landscaping part of the city. But the harmony of design that existed in Sardinia, for example, and in the Canary Islands, which reflect a cultural pride and heritage, was never realized. At times of political upheaval, when other ports in the region were closed down, Aqaba would brim with commercial activity, and long-range planning for the city would take a secondary role to economic expansion. Unfortunately, much of the time our energies were channeled into crisis management. One day, a government minister came to my office in great excitement to announce imminent plans to build an elevated tram in Petra and to pave the Sikh, the ancient dramatic stone entrance to the site. We were speechless. Very diplomatically, we stopped the project with the king's support. But this was just one instance of last-minute intervention due to lack of uniform planning standards and project coordination in the country. I met regularly with the mayor of Amman to explore ways in which we could develop more parks and open space for poorer children and their families. The press of refugees and displaced persons from Palestine, combined with the new affluence from the oil boom in the last half of the 1970s, was leading to the unchecked escalation of development. Open space, so important to the quality of life in an urban environment, was vanishing and being replaced by inadequate housing, high-rise hotels, or oversized extravagant villas in new upscale districts in the city. In just the few years I had lived in Amman, I had noticed fewer and fewer shepherds on the streets and more building on precious arable land. We also discussed ways to redevelop the downtown area. The original heart of the city had been largely abandoned as more and more people moved to the affluent suburbs of Amman. In our revival efforts, we had a number of unique sites to work with. The royal palaces where we lived and worked were downtown, as were the traditional souk or shopping areas, and the magnificent amphitheater built by the Romans. Also central to the downtown area was the ancient hilltop citadel, layered with all the civilizations that made up the region's history, from stone, bronze, and Iron Age settlements, beginning in 4500 BC, through Roman and Byzantine occupation, up through its Islamic flowering in the Umayyad period in the 8th century, when it grew into a city in itself, complete with governor's residence, baths, and mosque. One proposal called for building a state-of-the-art museum to house priceless artifacts unearthed from around the country and currently stored in what was called a museum on the citadel. This museum, no doubt once an elegant building, had become essentially a dusty, oversized storage shed. I was not alone in wanting to build an archaeological museum to properly display Jordan's magnificent collection of ancient artifacts. Not only were funds for the museum hard to come by, but also the project was hamstrung by the constant debate among archaeologists and site planners as to how much damage might be done to even more historic treasures by the building construction itself. Many artifacts would end up being dispersed among the small archaeological museums being developed at the time throughout Jordan, a development that created decentralized jewels of museums instead of one prestigious national institution. Over the years, as the citadel's archaeological excavations progressed, the site began to provide spectacular venues for concerts and cultural events that we also staged across the valley below in the ancient Roman Theater of Philadelphia. Restoring these ancient sites and amphitheaters to the living, artistic spaces they had been centuries ago added an immeasurable sense of continuity to Jordan's history. I took Queen Sophia, Abir, Haya, and Ali to a children's concert at the downtown Philadelphia Theater when the Queen and King Juan Carlos visited us in 1979. The atmosphere was electric. Thousands of people from all walks of life joined together to share in the festivities, generating an incomparable spirit of family and community, and even civic and national pride. The following year, we would inaugurate our first Jerash Festival, which took advantage of an entire Roman city as a performance and exhibition site. Two extraordinary exhibition spaces that contributed to revitalizing that area of the capital over the next few years were the direct result of perseverance by two of my first and closest Jordanian friends, Princess Wijdan and Suha Shoman. Princess Wijdan succeeded in raising public and private support to found Jordan's National Gallery of Fine Arts, which houses a unique permanent collection of works by contemporary artists from the developing world, with special emphasis on modern art from the Arab and Islamic countries. Darat al-Funun, Home for the Arts, established in 1993, was the brainchild of Suha Shoman and her husband Khalid, who purchased and renovated three turn-of-the-century houses overlooking the heart of Amman. The main residence, which houses Darat al-Funun's collection of contemporary Arab art, is typical of the traditional Eastern Mediterranean architectural style that prevailed in Amman during the early 1920s and 1930s, and its library and art studios are available to everyone free of charge. Darat al-Funun, which has revitalized Amman's oldest residential district, has brought art to a more populated, lower-income area of the city. Despite working hard to maintain momentum on various projects of my own, I did not have any trouble with my second pregnancy. After restricting my activities somewhat for the first 4 months, I resumed my full work schedule and my more ceremonial duties. Various Arab leaders were coming to Jordan to meet with my husband, and often he included me in a private welcome to our home. The first leader I greeted was Saddam Hussein, on his first visit to Jordan. I did not have time to form any opinion of him. I just shook his hand and went on about my business. The second leader I met required more time and attention because he and his entourage were in Jordan for a state visit. A memorable one. The guest of honor was the leader of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya, or Republic, Muammar al-Qaddafi. I had heard a great deal over the years about this unusual Arab leader who had overthrown Libya's pro-Western monarchy in 1969, replacing it with a strict Muslim socialist Arab republic. He had Libyanized the country, replacing every French or English word on street signs and menus with Arabic, and spending billions of the country's oil revenues on Libya's infrastructure, including the colossal Great Man-Made River project, which was being designed at the time by South Korea to carry underground water from deep under the Sahara Desert, 2,500 miles to the Libyan coast. Unfortunately, the hot, dry desert air would evaporate much of the water in the irrigation system's reservoirs, and the project never delivered on its promise. But it was a stunningly ambitious enterprise, nonetheless. We met Qaddafi and his wife Safiya at the airport. He arrived with an entourage of security guards who all appeared to have the same curly black hair as he did, cut in the same way, and they wore identical safari suits. Sprinkled among the security detail were female guards, a source of great fascination for Jordanians, because at the time there were no women active in Jordan's armed services, though I was advocating their inclusion, and considered as a model the Women's Royal Army Corps in Britain, which I had visited. Men were required to serve 2 years in national service at the time, and I saw no reason why women should not be engaged as well in the service of their country. Women did serve in the police, but in the army were limited to jobs as nurses, secretaries, and military communications experts, until the late 1980s, when one of my husband's daughters, Princess Aisha, and two female cousins went to Sandhurst and returned to Jordan as trained army officers. On the evening of the state banquet, my husband hosted dinner for the men, and I hosted dinner for the women, including the women bodyguards. The women were all wearing traditional, very brightly colored, flowing Libyan dress, and looked quite lovely. In preparation for the visit, everyone in our delegation had been reading Qaddafi's famous Green Book, a three-volume manifesto of his political and social philosophy. The senior female bodyguard sitting on one side of me recited long passages from it during the course of the meal, almost as if she were hoping to convert me to its views. While the first night of the state visit had gone according to plan, the second night was full of surprises. I had spent the day with Safiya, taking her to various institutions in Amman, in particular to see Jordan's state-of-the-art heart surgery unit. She had been a nurse in a hospital in Tripoli, she told me, and had met her husband there when he had had an emergency appendectomy. They had fallen in love, and she became his second wife, and the mother, ultimately, of 8 children. I went back to Hashemiya at the end of the day, quite exhausted, to find my husband equally tired after his long military program with Qaddafi. It had gone well enough, though Qaddafi had expressed his displeasure over and over about the street signs and shop names being written in English as well as Arabic. After that long day of official visits, the Qaddafis returned to the guest house downtown to rest. And there was no plan for us to meet again later that evening. While my husband and I were bathing and preparing for bed, our security rang us to say that the Qaddafis were in a car on their way to Hashemiya for dinner. We had made no arrangements for dinner. Take a long, scenic route to the house, a very, very long route, I told our security. Stall for time. Somehow we pulled it all together, including dinner, and when the Qaddafi's car drew up outside Hashemiya, we were dressed and waiting to greet them at the front door. we proceeded to have a remarkably pleasant evening. They were a delightful and charming couple, and even my husband was quite taken with how natural and comfortable they seemed, and how friendly the dinner was, as if we were the oldest and best of friends. It would not last. Shortly thereafter, on his return to Libya, Gaddafi started attacking my husband for his dealings with the West, and even threw in a gratuitous personal attack on me. Gaddafi was notoriously unpredictable. I was told, though I could not believe it, that he allegedly offered millions of dollars to Syria in 1982 to have Hussein's plane shot down by surface-to-air missiles during one of our trips to Aqaba, although President Hafez al-Assad reportedly rejected Gaddafi's assassination scheme, saying if the assassination were to be successful, no Arab leader would ever be safe in the air. Such was the nature of the neighborhood we lived in. Still, my husband never stopped trying to maintain open lines of communication with all the Arab leaders, including Gaddafi, no matter how strained relations became. It was extraordinary to me how much faith, tolerance, and stamina he expended to promote cooperative Arab action. A perfect case in point occurred in the fall of 1980, when King Hussein convened the 11th Arab Summit, the first such summit ever to be held in Amman. Jordanians were excited and proud that their small and relatively poor country was playing host to the leaders of 15 Arab countries, including the oil-rich nations of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, and the Gulf states of Bahrain, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. The choice of Jordan was testament to the prominent place King Hussein held in the Arab world by the sheer force of his character and personality, rather than the resources of his country. The preparations were enormous. It was no small job for a country like Jordan to mobilize the finances and the facilities to receive the Arab heads of state and their entourages. We had only one modest guest house and limited hotel rooms for large entourages and security, but somehow we made do. The summit was ostensibly an economic one. Hussein was pushing hard for joint Arab action in developing the economies of all the member states, based loosely on a similar cooperative effort in Europe at the time. Everyone seemed to agree, and a strategy was adopted, though when the leaders left Jordan and went back home, everybody seemed to forget what they had agreed to do. Despite Hussein's efforts, the Arab world was more fractured than ever. Egypt had been isolated from the Arab community since the Camp David Accords and was not at the summit. Neither were Libya and Iraq. Almost all the Arab countries, including Jordan, were supporting Iraq in its war with Iran, but Syria, which had an age-old competition with Iraq, and maverick Libya, were supporting Iran. Syrian President Hafez al-Assad, who opposed holding the Arab summit because he suspected that Jordan was encouraging the Muslim Brotherhood to challenge his regime, massed troops on Jordan's borders, and we found ourselves on the brink of war. The army called up 6,000 members of the Jordanian reserve forces, and another 16,000 citizens volunteered. I saw the overwhelming response myself when I paid a supportive visit to army facilities near our border with Syria during the summit. People were hiring cars and buses at their own expense to join their regiments against the threat of the Syrian aggression. Assad subsequently withdrew his forces, but the situation remained tense. It all seemed so counterproductive. If ancient enmities and modern slights continued to divide the Arab world, any chance for cooperative efforts for security, progress, and peace would be nullified. How could we break the cycle? It occurred to me one day, soon after the summit, that the answer might lie in our children. Perhaps we could lay the groundwork for more effective cooperation at every level in the future, If we began with Arab boys and girls at an early age and brought them together to appreciate their common bonds. Later that year, we convened the first annual Arab Children's Congress, gathering children from throughout the Arab world for 2 weeks of activities designed to promote understanding, tolerance, and solidarity. The children are encouraged to discuss and debate contemporary challenges facing the Arab nations and to appreciate their common cultural and historical bonds. It continues to be a very popular program, and some of the earlier delegates, now young adults, have forged lasting friendships. I kept up with my work as my pregnancy advanced, and to the consternation of my Jordanian obstetrician, traveled all over Jordan. There were villages to visit to launch the vaccination campaign, urban planning meetings to chair in Aqaba, and conditions in Palestinian refugee camps to check on. I either flew or drove my own car, a four-wheel drive jeep that was perfect for the rough roads and steep mountain tracks I often traveled as I visited different communities and projects in rural areas. I loved to drive myself because that was the only solitary respite I could find. My private space became the jeep, and there I would turn up the music, listening to Feruz, Bach, and Beethoven, Bruce Springsteen, and Fleetwood Mac, singing and probably even talking to myself, which must have caused some concern to the security car that always accompanied me. During the visits to these villages and to other areas of Jordan, I saw that the gap between rich and poor was growing. The economic gains of the business class were most welcome, of course, but having lived in Iran and traveled extensively through the Arab world, I was very aware of the destabilizing consequences of the 1970s oil boom. Hussein and I were both very aware that these new extremes of material consumption and changing lifestyles represented a radical shift in the country's traditions. When I had first arrived in Jordan, it was in the process of becoming a major regional medical and education center. The country's physicians and hospitals were providing services to many other Arab countries, some with far greater resources, but without the facilities and the local expertise available in Jordan. For more than a generation, Jordan had also provided the educated, specialized manpower to develop the infrastructures of the Gulf states and other parts of the Arab world. Remittances from Jordanians living as expatriates in other countries had become Jordan's largest source of national income, rising to as much as $800 million a year, especially after the oil boom in the mid-1970s, when increased demand and a rising pay scale for Jordanian doctors, nurses, teachers, planners, and engineers brought a new and sudden prosperity. Many people in the business sector were also enjoying windfall profits, and spending them as if there were no tomorrow. Where once they had lived simply but well, many now enjoyed unprecedented wealth and were passing on to their children a completely different set of values than those they themselves had grown up with. Jordan's prosperity was real, but its economic base was still fragile. The newly privileged were enjoying the lifestyle of an oil-rich country, but without the oil. Money from expatriates in the Gulf countries may have been pouring in, but it was not income that anyone could count on forever. I used to question my husband at length about the insecurity of the way we, as a country and family, were living. I know that as a family we did not always set the best example, and tried to identify ways we could be more responsible about our own lifestyles. In retrospect, I realized that part of the exuberant spending spree in Jordan was fueled by the same regional uncertainty that clouded people's ability to think long-term. Still, it was a troubling trend. The chief of the royal court shared my worry. Sharif Abdulhamid Sharaf knew the boom was not going to last, and made an attempt at least to inspire fiscal responsibility. When he became prime minister, he called on the government to reduce the budget by 10%, and he urged the people to ration their consumption of electricity and water, and to save some of their newly acquired money. his directive created an uproar. Many newly prosperous Jordanians adopted the attitude, "Why should we save? We should be free to spend whatever we want." The level of indignation was so high that Sharif Abdulhamid Sharaf and his wife Leila became targets of a campaign to discredit them. The Sharafs were building a modest house in Amman at the time, a project that had gotten no further than excavation for a foundation and preliminary cement columns, when reports began surfacing that the house would cost $3 million. The power of rumor was such that people started visiting the site to see the $3 million house. Even though there was little construction yet to be seen, people remained convinced of this excess. Why were these rumors accepted as fact? Because people wanted to believe that Sharif Abdulhamid was asking the people to save, at the same time he was spending a fortune. Our way of spending was also disturbing. Instead of reinvesting in the Jordanian economy, we were importing luxury goods and furnishings from Europe. Granted, there were limited furnishings available in Jordan at the time, and we were importing for our home as well. Nonetheless, I began to wonder what could be done to allow Jordanians to benefit from their own magnificent Arab heritage. Women on both sides of the Jordan River, for example, had traditionally designed and embroidered their own trousseaus, creating the 9 or 10 dresses they would wear throughout their married life, including a wedding dress that, for some, would also serve in death as a shroud. Finely embroidered cushions were also part of a traditional trousseau, with designs drawn largely from nature, trees, leaves, and feathers. These women were rightfully proud of their handiwork. Each dress and cushion was different. Each had fine stitching, and the colors were bright and varied. But what had once been a living part of the Jordanian and Palestinian tradition was rapidly dying out. Were it not for the extraordinary collection of these clothes amassed over the years by a Jordanian friend from Bethlehem, Widad Kawar, I would have known little of this rich heritage. Leila Jiryes, one particularly enterprising and talented designer, was combining the art of Palestinian and Jordanian needlework with new fabrics like watered silk. I made a point of wearing her lovely caftans whenever I could in public, and on official occasions, and this was not purely promotional on my part. The caftans also made excellent maternity clothes. I also supported initiatives like the Al-Aidi Jordan Handicraft Center, near the tourist hotels, that featured beautiful traditional textiles, woven rugs, embroidered cushions and clothing, and Hebron glass. Later, I also encouraged two creative and enterprising sisters, Rula and Reem Atalla, who started a handmade ceramics business in Amman using designs and calligraphy from ancient Middle Eastern civilizations and Islamic dynasties. We gave their beautiful glazed pieces, many painted with bas-relief imagery, as personal and official gifts, with great pride. One of my favorites from Silsal Ceramics was, and is, the Health, Happiness, and Good Fortune Bowl, which uses the unique Islamic art form of Arabic script to promise blessings on its owner. Another favorite bowl bears the very delicate lettering of an 11th-century Samarkand proverb that translates to, "Knowledge. The beginning of it is bitter to taste, but the end is sweeter than honey." Another rich aspect of Arab culture and heritage is language. I had begun learning Arabic as soon as I arrived in Amman, just as I had studied Farsi in Iran. After my engagement, I redoubled my efforts to read and become fluent in Arabic, a difficult, demanding language. The king was known and revered throughout the Arab-speaking world for his masterful command of Arabic. Most people speak it in their colloquial dialect, but Hussein spoke classical Arabic with such a beauty and eloquence that Arabs all over the region tuned in just to listen to him on the radio or television. My husband's mastery of the language and his deep, sonorous delivery accorded him special respect. I had not realized before I came to Jordan how central language is to Arab identity. Arabic is the language of the Quran, which all Muslims, whether in the Middle East, the Far East, Europe, or the United States, need to learn in order to read and recite their daily prayers. My husband's command of vocabulary and nuance was achieved over a lifetime of study of the holy text. Though he knew much of the Quran by heart, he read it over and over again, and he never stopped seeking greater and greater understanding of its message. I had begun with lessons in colloquial Arabic, which after my marriage I expanded to include the classical form used in public speaking. I arranged a heavy weekly schedule with a tutor. Improving my Arabic was my top priority, after my husband and my family. However, Hussein would suddenly show up wanting to go for a drive, visit family, or take the children out, constantly sabotaging these lessons. The tutor and I were unable to refuse him. Nonetheless, I continued as best I could with my reading lessons of the Quran, Arabic poetry, the newspapers, and grappling with the impenetrable mysteries of grammar. My favorite study moments involved helping my stepchildren with their Arabic homework, which was an unexpected treat and boost to my confidence. Abir and then Haya would cuddle up on my bed with me at the end of the day, and we would read their first Arabic textbooks together. Eventually, I would learn enough and be secure enough to converse in Arabic and even deliver formal speeches. But it would be a long, difficult process that always left me with a raw feeling of inadequacy. When distractions and other commitments put increasing pressure on my formal lessons, I found some bright, wonderful young women to work with me on special projects and my language skills simultaneously. But I was constantly frustrated by my inability to master the language at a truly sophisticated level of fluency. Whereas the concern for this pregnancy following my miscarriage had been premature birth, the opposite worry had emerged by the end of my pregnancy. George Pinker, the British obstetrician, had planned his spring holiday in Jordan around the due date in order to assist in the delivery, but the baby had no intention of meeting someone else's schedule. There was some talk of labor being induced. However, I did not want to do anything unnatural, so Mr. Pinker left. To the despair of my doctor, Arif Bataine, I continued my field work in various communities around the capital. He would often accompany me, complaining that he exercised more vigorously on those trips than he did when working out, and he always returned with an exaggerated account of our adventures to amuse my husband. I kept maintaining that women through the ages had given birth in fields and gone right back to work, and I did not see why their descendants should be less capable. A deeply flawed argument, I know, given the high infant and maternal mortality rates even today in many underdeveloped countries. Over the next 6 years, Arif must have become quite fit as he supervised all my pregnancies. He also became a great friend. I had been told over and over again by numerous members of the family that we absolutely had to hire a Norland nanny to help us with the baby. Norland's College, located in England, is internationally renowned from the Gulf to Beverly Hills as the elite nanny training college, providing top-class nannies who have learned everything from handicrafts to nutrition, with a bit of child psychology thrown in. We were lucky to find a great candidate, Diane Smith, who soldiered on with us in spite of a bomb scare at Heathrow that delayed her first flight to Jordan 5 hours. My husband tried to put her at ease when he walked in on us during her explanation of the delay. He took her aside afterward and asked, "Are you ready to go to the hospital at a moment's notice?" When she replied, "All ready," he said, "Come and see." And he took her to where he had laid out his clothes long before. He also shaved off his beard, presumably because he wanted to welcome the baby into the world clean-shaven. His friends and family had been after him for some time to get rid of his beard, but I thought it made him look dashing. I had not advocated either way. It was his face, after all. But seeing him beardless for the first time was a shock. I had come into the bathroom, our private refuge, to chat with him while he was taking a shower. On this particular day we were talking away when I suddenly realized there was a man in the steamy shower who did not look at all like the man I had been married to for the past year. I started to blush and feel very shy. I quickly adjusted, however, for this new person was just as handsome and dashing as his predecessor. Hussein knew our baby's gender. The first advanced ultrasound machine had just arrived in Jordan, and the technology had progressed to the point that the sex of the baby could be reasonably well determined in utero. My husband, who had an insatiable curiosity, wanted to know. I made him and the doctor swear not to tell me, as I would for all our children. Our miracle stubbornly refused to happen. One day followed another as the due date passed. My stepchildren were getting very impatient, especially Abdullah and Faisal, who were due to leave Jordan to return to their schools in the United States and wanted to be here for the birth. Tapioca became the code word between the boys and us for news of the birth. My husband took me on long helicopter and motorcycle rides, hoping to set something in motion, but all we had was fun. We decided to see if a change in air pressure would start the birth process, so he flew me up to the highest peak in Jordan in his helicopter, and then descended rapidly to the lowest point on earth, the Dead Sea. Nothing. The medical decision was finally taken to induce labor. After 6 agonizing hours, our son, Hamza, finally decided to be born just hours before his older brothers departed for school, on March 29, 1980. Everyone in the delivery room was so excited when he was born that I do not think I actually met Hamza until some time later, when he was finally brought into my room after doing the rounds of family and friends and having his first checkup. He was wide awake, and when my husband came in much later, Hamza and I were in the midst of conversation, which I sincerely believed was not as one-sided as it may have seemed. I could not stop staring at him in amazement. I had never thought of myself as an especially maternal person, and I was stunned by the intensity of my feelings of love for my firstborn child. I do not remember what I had expected, but his large, round, funny face and bald head and wise, old, soulful eyes took most of my breath away. I expended the rest by talking to him all night. There were streams of people coming to the hospital to see Hamza. Everybody in Jordan, it seemed, stopped by my room at some point to say, "Mabruk, congratulations." Friends, representatives of organizations I worked with, religious figures, government officials, politicians, business people, NGO representatives, tribal leaders, diplomats, all came and sat for a while with Hussein or in the room with me. Their response moved me deeply, as a reflection of the unique Jordanian family spirit, but it was also quite exhausting for a new mother. I was just learning to nurse, and I wanted to give this very special baby every bit of my attention and love. Though this was his 9th child, my husband and Hamza shared a uniquely empathetic relationship and an affinity for each other, which would bond them in a special way until the day my husband died. Perhaps it was because Hamza rarely slept as a baby. He would catnap, but mostly he was alert and happy day and night, as long as I was nursing him, which meant we spent an enormous amount of time with him, particularly during the evenings when he was always wide awake. On those rare occasions when Hamza actually slept, we would often go into his room at night and just stare at him. Hussein even gave up smoking again after Hamza was born. My husband and I chose the name Hamza to honor a Hashemite ancestor and a favorite uncle of the Prophet Muhammad. Hamza's story was one of great historical importance. Born in Mecca in 570, he and the Prophet were the same age and very close friends as children. As a young man, Hamza was known far and wide for his horsemanship and his great strength, which earned him the title Lion of the Desert. After he killed an attacking lion with a single javelin throw and rode back into Mecca with the lion skin over his saddle. Because of his renown in Mecca, Hamza's conversion to Islam gave great credibility to the monotheistic belief system that Muhammad was espousing, and he then became known as the Lion of God and his Prophet. His beliefs cost him his life. Hamza was cut down defending the Prophet in the religious wars that followed, earning him a hallowed place in Islam as the Master of All Martyrs, a name given to him by the Prophet. Our Hamza, whose full name is Hamza bin al-Husayn, Hamza son of al-Husayn, formerly received his name in a Hashemite family ritual conducted by the head religious sheikh in Jordan. The male members of the family assembled for the naming ceremony, which traditionally called for the father to hand the baby to my husband as the senior member of the family, who would in turn hand the baby to the sheikh. The sheikh then whispered the call to prayer into each of the newborn's ears so that it would be one of the first things the child heard, and then he would whisper the child's name in both ears and give the baby back to the father. The ritual was only slightly different in our case. Hussein had already named our son privately in our bedroom, as he would all our children. He had the right to do so, being the spiritual leader and head of the Hashemite family. Beyond Jordan itself, Hamza's birth prompted extraordinary and unexpected congratulations from Arab leaders and friends, so much so that my husband was slightly taken aback. Congratulatory messages and gifts flooded in from the Arab world, some from leaders whose relationships with my husband had been competitive or conflicted. Our choice of Hamza as a name was greeted with particular enthusiasm. My husband had named his other sons, predictably after his grandfather and his great-uncles, and there was one name left, Zayd. Everyone assumed that we would choose it, but there was already a Zayd Hussein in the extended family, with a very colorful reputation, and we thought our son should begin life with a fresh slate. From the moment of Hamza's birth, I spoke only Arabic to him, whatever I had mastered up to that point. Not only did I think it was the right thing to do, I had seen the struggle the other children were having with Arabic when they had first learned English, which is much easier. I decided that Hamza and I would learn Arabic together, so I shared everything I was learning with him while I nursed him. When he started on his first words some months later, it was in Arabic. Ta-ta-tayara, the word for airplane, prompted no doubt by the constant overwhelming sound of planes over Al-Nadwa. My husband was so astonished to hear his young son speaking Arabic that he immediately usurped my project. This meant that as my son's Arabic began to outstrip my own, he spoke Arabic with one parent and English with the other. The normal pattern for bilingual children, but disastrous to my plans to learn the language with him. At least he and his siblings grew up fluent. We took the baby with us everywhere, including, in June 1980, our first state visit to the United States since our marriage, when Hamza was only 2 months old. I checked with his pediatrician to make sure traveling would not adversely affect Hamza in any way, and was relieved when the doctor validated my maternal instincts by saying it was much better for children under 18 months to travel with their parents than to be separated from them. He also reassured me that children handle jet travel and time changes much more easily than adults. The net result was that my children would be better traveled by the time they were toddlers than most people are in a lifetime, having been to virtually every country in Europe and Asia, as well as Pakistan, India, the Soviet Union, numerous Arab countries, and, of course, the United States. We flew the Royal Squadron's Boeing 727, with my husband at the controls for most flights. He was a superb pilot, and he loved to tease his more faint-hearted passengers by what I would call his extreme flying. One episode I love to remember involved his approach to the Aqaba airport one day, when he descended so low that we virtually skimmed the Gulf waters between two tankers moored close to our jetty, flying at a level below their superstructure. Sitting behind him in the cockpit, I remember looking up at the tanker towers, and then barely clearing the beach and our home as we began our approach to the airport beyond. Even I was caught off guard. Whenever officials, friends, family, and security guards who were nervous flyers saw Hussein striding toward the cockpit with a certain gleam in his eye, they would hurriedly get out their compasses to identify the direction of Mecca and start to pray. The children loved flying with him, as did I. He was particularly inventive when flying his helicopter in Jordan, turning the faces of his security guards ashen. Hamza loved his father's acrobatic flying from the beginning. He would laugh and say, "More, Baba, more!" which would bring an even paler hue to the security guards. Sometimes Hussein went a bit too far, as he did once in Aqaba when Hamza was a tiny baby. He flew so low over the beach before landing at our helicopter pad that he blew all the beach umbrellas out of their stands, the beach chairs into the water, and sand all over Hamza, who was on the beach in his big old-fashioned pram. I found the chaotic scene quite funny, but Hamza's nanny, Diane, gave my husband a lecture about jeopardizing his son's well-being. The king was appropriately apologetic, but everyone knew that he would do it again. We had to take an enormous amount of equipment with us when we began traveling with Hamza, because we never knew if we would find the right kind of cot, bath, sterilizers, and whatever else, where we were going. My husband used to joke that Hamza had more luggage to transport than he did, so Hamza's nanny eventually learned to hide it in the plane so the king would not see it being loaded. That first flight to America turned out to be quite trying. We flew to England first, then on to the United States. We stopped to refuel at Gander, Newfoundland, but it was very late at night and the airport was closed. We had to walk up and down the tarmac in the freezing cold until someone arrived to unlock the doors and let us into the airport building. Hamza caught a cold that lasted our entire stay, and Diane had so little sleep that she would become ill herself on the flight back to Heathrow and faint. My husband would tease her forever after that she was so nervous about his flying that she had collapsed with fright. I wondered why I was not more nervous myself when we started to descend into Washington, D.C. in June 1980. I had not been back to America in the 2 years since we had married. Relations between the United States and Jordan had become so strained since Camp David that when my husband had flown to America the prior fall to address the United Nations, he had not been invited to meet with President Carter. This trip was a first for all of us. My first visit to the United States as my husband's wife, our first state visit together to the White House, and Hamza's inaugural visit to Washington. Chapter 10. America Through New Eyes. I was back in America. In the 2 years since I had left the United States, I had married and given birth to my first child. Jordan had become home. My life there was fast-paced and always eventful. Between the ever-churning politics of the region and the complex dynamics of the royal court, it could not be otherwise. In truth, I had hardly had time to miss America, but now my heart skipped a beat as we approached the runway at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C., the city of my birth, a place brimming with fond memories of my youth. I was in the cockpit's jump seat behind my husband, who was piloting our plane. My heart fluttered again when the Jordanian and American national anthems were played at the opening lawn ceremony at the White House. Both songs stirred my senses. Both countries had a claim on me. But this was not a sentimental journey. the king and I had no illusions about the hard work ahead. During the stopover in London, we had talked late into the night, considering all the points of contention between the United States and Jordan, and how some of these differences might be bridged. This much was clear. President Carter was deeply invested in the Camp David Accords and could not abide my husband's criticism of its failings. My husband, for his part, had his convictions to uphold. He was committed to supporting any initiative that might lead to peace in the Middle East, but he knew that would not be possible without granting self-determination to the Palestinians and the return of the occupied territories. It was hard to imagine an easy rapprochement, and harder still to have anticipated what would come next. We arrived at Blair House, the official guest house for visiting dignitaries, located across the street from the White House. We were welcomed with great excitement, both because Hussein was already a favorite guest of the Blair House staff, and because Hamza was the first baby ever to stay there. After we were escorted to our rooms, we put the baby to bed and began to unpack. Suddenly, there on the television screen was President Sadat, inveighing against my husband for being an opportunist, blocking the path of peace, and withholding promised support. I watched with open-mouthed shock. Hussein had witnessed this sort of display many times, but even he was taken aback. His response was to take the long view. "I know where I stand," he told reporters as we arrived at the White House for the state dinner. "I have always been concerned with life for the generations to come. For me, that is more important than today's disagreements." But there was no misunderstanding the timing of Sadat's invective. It coincided with our arrival in Washington, D.C., and I could not help but view it as a deliberate attempt to undermine my husband's talks with the administration and further strain Jordan's relations with Washington. There was a lot at stake for Jordan. Congress was withholding all military aid to the country, a way of pressuring the king to drop his objections to Camp David. More significant, Sadat's separate peace with Israel had brought a new wave of turmoil to the Middle East. Having successfully neutralized Egypt, Israel had invaded Lebanon in 1978 and was occupying the south of the country, between the Litani River and the Israeli border. Closer to home, Begin had sidestepped the vaguely stated restrictions in the Accords by allowing new Jewish settlements to be built on the West Bank. By 1980, the Israelis had expropriated roughly one-third of the pre-1948 Palestinian lands. There were upward of 74 settlements and residential areas on the occupied West Bank, the number of settlers in that one area alone having grown from 5,000 before the Accords to more than 12,000 in less than 2 years. We watched in horror while the Israeli government continued to transform the occupied West Bank into a network of armed Israeli camps, connected by new roads that bypassed and isolated Palestinian villages, in blatant violation of international law. How was this policy any less odious than racial apartheid in Africa, which the West had so widely condemned? Israel was also playing havoc with the region's scarce water resources. By the time of our state visit to Washington in 1980, Israel had seized control of the occupied West Bank's water supply by either confiscating or buying Palestinian land for its own use. What wells the Palestinians still owned were being rendered useless. By boring deeper wells, the Israelis were systematically drying up or salinizing Palestinian water. Israel's unslakable thirst for water to support its ever-growing immigrant population and the expansion of its industry and agriculture had multiplied fourfold since 1948, with no end in sight. These were crucial issues, but Arab leaders like my husband, who spoke truthfully about them, were demonized in the West for creating obstacles to peace. Lost in the rhetoric was the fact that at the Baghdad summit, all the attending Arab leaders had reaffirmed their commitment to a just peace only a few months before our state visit to Washington. Hussein, for one, had cooperated with every peace initiative proposed by the United Nations and by the United States during the presidencies of Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. After eagerly embracing the Carter proposal, he had sought to reactivate the Geneva Conference in 1977 by rallying all the Arab countries to participate. He had almost reached that goal when the Carter administration took a separate track with Egypt. King Hussein was so concerned about the deteriorating situation in the region that in the fall of 1979 he had addressed the United Nations General Assembly for the first time since the 1967 war, asking the Security Council for its help in finding a resolution to the plight of the Palestinians. The official Israeli political line has never once provided a glimpse of possible recognition of the Palestinians as a people with a right to a free and secure existence based on self-determination, he said to the members. Rather, it has insisted on smearing the Arab image by projecting the Palestinians as no more than terrorists. For speaking out in this way, my husband was branded as a turncoat by President Carter. All of us were angered when Hussein subsequently became a spokesman for the most radical Arabs, Carter would write in his presidential memoir.